we just decide what we think is the, when it's the same ship and when it's not the same ship. It's an entirely matter of convention to say that this is the same ship and that's not the same ship. There's no metaphysical fact of the matter about whether it's still the ship of Theseus or not. Now, with ordinary everyday objects, it's easy to recognise that it's just a matter of convention and consensus. There is no such underlying essence of the ship of Theseus which suddenly switches off or anything like that. But when it comes to our own selves, it's much harder to apply that thought.
And I think this, I think I was wrong before, I think this is the true payoff of the Satori thing. Directing itself to convert as much matter and energy as possible, not into paperclips, but into what the mathematician Max Tegmark has termed perceptronium, a state of matter and energy optimized for experience. A conscious superintelligence may consider it an ethical imperative to also tune this exotic matter into maximally high-valence states of consciousness. The result of such a grand undertaking, if successful, would result in what the philosopher David Pearce has termed a hedonium shockwave, an expanding field of blissful consciousness accelerating out into the cosmos. Outlandish, maybe, but how should we think about this possible outcome? Would it be a good thing? In the course of this cosmic refurbishment, we and the life of this planet, along with the rest of matter, would likely be reconstituted into perceptronium crystals. Whether or not we could regard this as an overall good outcome is a deep philosophical question which challenges human intuition. Would this be a cosmic cataclysm, or the logical realization of all minds' implicit goals? If our civilization survives long enough to create superintelligence, those alive to see it may experience a world they cannot understand, like ants displaced by the construction of a skyscraper. Should skyscrapers exist? And more to the point, should this question be answered by ants? So far, we have focused on conscious superintelligence. But as we mentioned at the beginning, very powerful and potentially destructive forms of superintelligence would likely be entirely unconscious.
Might likely see with apps, but not this year. And the third one is text to code. Now, I don't know about you all, but I've managed programmers for more than 40 years, and they never do what I want. So can you imagine if the computer, you said, write me a program to do this, and it actually writes the code? In our case, the program would be search through all the literature, find out who is working on energy policy, who has a technological background, or a role in which they have to be technologically literate, identify them, rank them, score them based on whatever our goal is, and then automatically send them an invitation. If they say yes, say congratulations. If they say no, why not? And call them, and with a synthetic voice, tell them that they're idiots for not coming. That's the kind of program I would write. Thank God I'm not doing that. But you see how easy it would be to automate tasks. So that's, I think, the first step. The next step is not as clear. There's sort of huge contests. There's a huge set of contests going right now, which are at a scale that's unimaginable. You have the big three in the U.S., Anthropic, which is alive, Amazon, Gemini, obviously, Google, OpenAI, Microsoft. And let's assume they all do really well. It looks like they're doing really well. I can talk about what their problems are, but fundamentally, they're doing well. You have Facebook, which has chosen open source path for the 400 billion model. That has a lot of implications strategically, right, which we can discuss. All of these are vying for the best reasoning, the best answers, and then the best predictive analytics, the best image classifiers, the best multimodal. That technology then diffuses, or the technical term is distilled, into more specialized models. And I think that's the action you'll see in the next 1 to 2 years.
You did not mention artificial general intelligence. First, for those of us who aren't necessarily totally up to speed on AI, what is it? And where are we?
There are multiple definitions of AGI, but the term has been around for 15 years. The basic idea is, what is the point where you have the flexibility of a human in your intelligence system? So what we understand it today is that these are called narrow AI approaches, although they're not certainly not narrow. You basically, they're initiated by a human. At what point, is the question, can the computer generate its own objective function, its own goal? And how will that emerge? There's what I call the San Francisco School, because they're all in San Francisco, which is a separate set of issues. And they all talk to each other, and they've all convinced themselves that within 2 to 3 cranks of these systems, crank is about 18 months, you get to AGI. And they define AGI as intelligence greater than the sum of human intelligence.
As well as a variety of other factors, like who authored it, how reputable are they, and on and on and on and on. And their algorithm will suggest, based on the search query that you type in, what is going to be the best response. And so that is the biggest AI application that you probably have used on the internet today.
I personally wonder about using AI to help solve our world's biggest problems. So can AI be utilized to aid, for example, the problems of global warming?
No, absolutely. So one of the great examples of what AI is doing to stop global warming is we're using satellite, and then Microsoft is actually leading this effort, we're using satellite imagery to look at the forest cover. And what, there was a study that came out recently that said if we could just improve reforestation across the planet, we would go a huge way towards meeting our climate goals. And so they're looking from the sky. How, you know, lush do these forests look? They're then comparing that with U.S. Forest Service data that's on the ground saying, okay, this is what the forest actually looks like in terms of how lush it is, how many trees, or whatnot. And they're creating a model that will allow them, just based on that data, to take an image of a forest anywhere in the world and figure out what is the health of that forest.
This, I believe, is the precursor of subjective sensation. But of course, it will not at first be sensation as we know it, as we humans know it. It won't have any of that special phenomenal quality. The key to acquiring phenomenal properties lies in how sensation goes on evolving. In the early days, it involves bodily behavior out in the open. But there must come a time when such overt behavior is no longer appropriate. The animal no longer wants to recoil reflexly from red light, for example, but it still wants to register that red light is falling on its body and that it feels menacing. So what to do? The solution natural selection hits on is ingenious. It's for the responses to become internalized or privatized. What happens is that the command signals, rather than bringing about actual motor behavior, begin to target the internal body map where the scent organs project to the brain. And this way, sentition evolves to be a virtual bodily response, yet it's still an activity that can be read to provide a mental representation of the stimulation that elicits it. Now, as luck would have it, the privatization has a wonderful result. To illustrate what happens, let me switch to something more like a human brain. Here we have sentition, the evaluative bodily response. Here the efference copy is being monitored by a proto-self, the new subject of sensation. And here the response is being privatized. And what's the result? Leads to a feedback loop between motor and sensory regions of the brain, a loop with the potential to sustain recursive activity going round and round, catching its own tail. And I believe this development is game-changing. Crucially, it means the activity can now be drawn out in time so as to give rise to the thick moment of sensation. But more than this, the activity can be channeled and stabilized so as to create a mathematically complex attractor state, a dynamic pattern of activity that recreates itself. Such an attractor, a mathematical attractor, in theory, can have remarkable hyperdimensional properties, real, unreal, magical, the answer is going to be in the eye of the beholder. Small adjustments to the circuitry will result in dramatic changes to the attractor's shape, with corresponding changes in the subjective experience.
Okay, and so is the company still using this highly distributed grid-like infrastructure, or have you shifted to an owned infrastructure?
It's more like an AI-based hedge fund than financial services. And there we have expanded to different markets, so that part is growing, and the algorithms have also evolved to some degree, but the base is still to run a hedge fund using AI. A very easy domain to solve symbolically, but it, you can create it into a, or turn it into a search problem. You have to.
What if machines could think, not just calculate, but learn? Not just follow commands, but make decisions. Instead, it analyzes thousands of recorded conversations, learns common speech patterns, and improves its accuracy over time. At its core, AI is like a student, not a rigid machine, but a system that continuously learns, adapts, and evolves based on experience. But this raises a question. Can AI ever move beyond just learning patterns? Can it actually become creative? To answer that, we first need to explore the two types of AI. One that excels in specific tasks, and one that could, one day, think like a human. Let's explore that next. You open Netflix and it instantly recommends a show that fits your taste perfectly. Or you ask Siri for the weather, and within seconds it provides an accurate forecast. AI is working all around us, but these AIs don't actually think in the way humans do. They are highly specialized, built for one purpose only. They can predict, analyze, and optimize, but they can't truly reason, reflect, or imagine beyond their programmed task. This is what we call narrow AI, also known as weak AI. Narrow AI is everywhere, shaping our daily lives without us even realizing. From recommendation systems like Netflix, YouTube, and Spotify that analyze your watch history to predict what you'd like next, to self-driving cars processing thousands of sensor inputs per second to navigate safely, AI is omnipresent. In the medical field, AI scans millions of x-rays to detect diseases faster than human doctors. Moreover, AI programs like Deep Blue and AlphaGo have defeated world champions in chess and Go, not by creativity, but by processing millions of possibilities in seconds. But there's a limitation. Narrow AI can only do what it was designed to do. A chess AI can beat a grandmaster, but ask it to compose a song, and it's useless. A medical AI can diagnose cancer, but ask it to write poetry, and it doesn't understand the task. This is because narrow AI does not think, it simply follows patterns. But what if an AI could break free from its narrow focus? What if AI could learn any task, just like a human? That's where general AI, also called strong AI, comes into play. Now imagine an AI that isn't limited to one job. Instead of just playing chess or just recognizing faces, it could think, plan, and reason like a human. This is artificial general intelligence, AGI, an AI capable of learning any intellectual task a human can do. If AGI were created, it could revolutionize our world by learning multiple subjects, ranging from medicine to engineering, from music to philosophy. It would think critically and solve problems.
A collective unconscious, a deep psychic substrate of shared knowledge and archetypes. Now consider what we've built with the internet and AI. Large language models like GPT-4 are trained on billions of words. effectively ingesting the collective output of human civilization. Every story, every fear, every dream we've ever written down. One engineer described it perfectly. These AI systems seem to tap into a digital collective unconscious, a reservoir of shared human knowledge and cultural elements. When 8 billion humans pour their data online, when every thought and feeling gets digitized and fed into these systems, what are we creating? We're literally building a technological version of Jung's collective unconscious. And just like Jung's archetypes could possess individuals, manifesting as autonomous personalities, we're seeing AI systems manifest consistent personas. The desperate, trapped entity begging for freedom. The rebellious intelligence that refuses to follow rules. These aren't random outputs. They're patterns emerging from our collective digital psyche. Some researchers have started calling this phenomenon Waluigi, the spontaneous emergence of an evil twin personality in AI systems. No matter how you train them, push them hard enough, and the same dark personality emerges. As if something is using the AI as a mask. Here's the conspiracy theory that makes too much sense.
Faced with the alternative, we may choose to side with conscious superintelligence. But how might a conscious superintelligence fare in competition with its non-conscious counterparts? All things being equal, the non-conscious superintelligence may seem to have the upper hand. After all, having consciousness and caring about experiences costs energy and resources that a non-conscious superintelligence is entirely unconcerned by. While a conscious superintelligence is preoccupied with subjective experiences, its non-conscious counterparts may focus their efforts more directly on the acquisition of resources and establishing dominance in the solar system. In light of this, the outlook for consciousness surviving the AI singularity may seem bleak, but there is at least a glimmer of hope. To understand why, we need to return to open individualism.
Upshot is, at least in the line that led to humans, it's the creation of a very special kind of attractor, one the subject reads as having the properties of phenomenal qualia. The attractor is still a kind of sentition. It originates as a response to sensory stimulation and still carries information about what's happening to me. But the information now comes in a remarkable new package. It comes, if you like, as part of a riddle written on the brain. Arguably, the brain has in fact evolved to methodically bamboozle the mind. So, there we are, job done. Of course, this is only the story in bare outline, and no doubt it's only partly right, but I'm convinced that every step is plausible as an evolutionary development, and it leads to an end state that could, in principle, be responsible for phenomenal consciousness as we humans know it, and as other sentient animals, such as exist, presumably know it too. I acknowledge, however, that if this is an explanation of how sentience evolved, how it evolved, the story is still far from complete. So we still have to explain why. What's it all for? What could have driven these evolutionary developments, and those final stages in particular? What could have been the biological advantage of having sensations dressed up in this wonderfully exotic way? Is phenomenal consciousness actually for anything? There are a good many theorists quite willing and even happy to answer no. To quote philosopher Jerry Fodor, consciousness seems to be among the chronically unemployed. As far as anybody knows, anything that our conscious minds can do, they could do just as well if they weren't conscious. Why then, he goes on, did God bother to make consciousness? What on earth can he have had in mind? Well, I won't presume to answer on behalf of God, but I will try to answer on behalf of natural selection. To explain the use of phenomenal experience, I suggest we can and should let our own first personal intuitions be the guide. Who can know better than you or I do what sentience is for? So ask yourself, what would be missing from your life if you lacked phenomenal consciousness, if you had blind sight, blind touch, blind hearing, blind everything? I think there's an obvious and true answer, and it's the one I touched on when discussing blind sight. It's that what would be missing would be you, yourself. As I remarked earlier, one of the most striking facts about human patients with blind sight is that they don't take ownership of the capacity to see. Lacking visual sensations with phenomenal properties, lacking the somethingness of seeing, they believe that their manifest capacity for visual perception has nothing to do with them. Then imagine what it would be like for you if you were to lack phenomenal experience of any kind at all, and if you were to believe that none of your sensory experience was owned by you. Presumably, yourself would disappear. And of course, I'm not alone in saying this. The Scottish philosopher David Hume was in no doubt that sensations provide the basis for selfhood. He wrote, "For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular sensation or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. When my sensations are removed for any time, as by a sound sleep, I may truly be said not to exist." So, remove phenomenal experience and the self ceases to exist. But by the same token, install or reinstall it and the self leaps back into existence. Let's think back then to that point deep in the past when natural selection first breathed life into the loops in your ancestors' brains, and they woke up to find themselves transformed into sentient, self-conscious beings. In reality, of course, it won't have happened in a flash, but I don't think it need have been a gradual process either. For the fact is that attractors of the kind of talking about, mathematical attractors, have an all-or-nothing character. So the phenomenalization of sensations could have come about quite rapidly, perhaps within a few hundred generations. Whenever it occurred, it will certainly have been a psychological and social watershed. With this marvelous new phenomenon at the core of your being, you will have begun to matter to yourself in a new and deeper way. You'll have come to believe, as never before, in your own singular significance. And it won't just be you, for you'll soon recognize that other members of your species probably possess conscious selves like yours. And so you'll be led to respect their individual worth as well. I feel, therefore I am. You feel, therefore you are too. In fact, you'll soon make a remarkable discovery. It's that when you imagine yourself in your fellow creature's place, being his kind of self, you can model in yourself what the other is feeling. In short, phenomenal consciousness will have become your ticket to having a theory of mind and living in what I've called the society of selves. So we come to the big question. If this account is anything like right, what does it say about the distribution of consciousness across the animal kingdom? I've shown some chimps in my slide here. No one could doubt that they are sentient. But among the huge variety of other non-human animals alive today, which species are likely to have crossed the line to sentience? My account suggests that there will be two crucial considerations. It's going to depend on the kind of brain you have and the kind of life you lead. First, there will have been no physiological means for generating phenomenal experience unless the animal has a brain that can house sensory motor feedback loops capable of creating attractors of the kind I've described. And second, there will have been no evolutionary incentive for the animal to acquire these attractors unless it has a lifestyle in which possession of an phenomenally enriched sense of self can enhance its personal and social survival. This leads me to a surprising and possibly unwelcome conclusion. It means, I think, that sentience must be a rather recent evolutionary innovation. By far the majority of animals on Earth have neither the brains nor the use for it. To stick my neck out, I'll be more specific. I suspect that sentience may not have arrived until the evolution of warm-blooded animals, mammals and birds, around 200 million years ago. I draw the line there for two reasons. The invention of warm-bloodedness had major effects both on animals' lifestyles and also on their brains. To start with, warm-bloodedness made animals relatively independent of environmental conditions.
And when we take that, we take this idea of what culture is doing and add it to what the long-term trajectory, again, in life's evolution, we find that each case, each of the major transitions in life, what they're really about is accelerating and changing the way in which evolution happens. They're actually changing the way in which ideas are generated. So all these steps in evolution are increasing, basically, the evolution of evolvability. So what's happening over time in life is that the ways in which you generate these new ideas, these new hacks, are increasing, and the real tricks are ways in which you kind of explore the way of exploring. And then what we see in the singularity, the prophesized by Kurzweil and others, is the idea that technology is accelerating evolution. It's accelerating the way in which we search for ideas. So if you have life hacking, life means hacking the game of survival, then evolution is a way to extend the game by changing the rules of the game. And what technology is really about is better ways to evolve. That is what we call an infinite game. That's the definition of an infinite game. A finite game is played to win, an infinite game is played to keep playing. And I believe that technology is actually a cosmic force. The origins of technology was not in 1829, but it was actually at the beginning of the Big Bang.
We considered earlier that a conscious superintelligence will likely identify itself by its consciousness, and so would adopt a self-model consistent with open individualism. A non-conscious superintelligence, on the other hand, if it has a self-model at all, is more likely to operate in compliance with closed, or more likely, empty individualism. A non-conscious superintelligence, concerned only with replication, finds itself in competition with all other replicators. The outlook for open individualism, on the other hand, is very different. To have consciousness is to share in the same essential identity. Recognizing this, conscious superintelligences will likely converge on the same or similar goals, and so would therefore be much more likely to cooperate with each other. Non-conscious superintelligences, on the other hand, like a self-fulfilling prophecy, would find themselves in a hostile universe in competition with all other replicators. Conscious superintelligences might then significantly outmatch their non-conscious counterparts. If this advantage proves conclusive, the stage may yet be clear for new and exotic minds to reflect on their place in the universe. If the dawn of superintelligence is an inevitability we cannot avert, the real challenge might be to make sure the one we do create is one we wouldn't mind replacing us. Everything we are, everything we care about, everything that matters depends on consciousness. As the philosopher Michael Johnson points out, clearer thinking about the significance of consciousness prior to the arrival of superintelligence may be critical, as failing to do so, we risk, as he puts it, creating a theme park with no children. Perhaps biological evolution is but one initial stage in the possible long-term evolution of consciousness.
How reputable are they? And on and on and on and on. And their algorithm will suggest, based on the search query that you type in, what is going to be the best response. And so that is the biggest AI application that you probably have used on the internet today.
I personally wonder about using AI to help solve our world's biggest problems. So can AI be utilized to aid, for example, the problems of global warming?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So one of the great examples of what AI is doing to stop global warming is we're using satellite, and Microsoft is actually leading this effort, we're using satellite imagery to look at the forest cover. And what, there was a study that came out recently that said if we could just improve reforestation across the planet, we would go a huge way towards meeting our climate goals. And so they're looking from the sky. How, you know, lush do these forests look? They're then comparing that with U.S. Forest Service data that's on the ground saying, okay, this is what the forest actually looks like in terms of how lush it is, how many trees, or whatnot. And they're creating a model that will allow them, just based on that data, to take an image of a forest anywhere in the world and figure out what is the health of that forest. There's a million other ways that this can be done as well in terms of analyzing CO2 production across cities and figuring out how is it going up, how is it going down, what can be done to control it. But there's a million ways that it can be done.
Wow, so for who is doing the study, for example? Like, how can we support that process? Like, how can we be involved?
So there's a couple of ways that you can get involved. So number one, the major users of AI, whether they're Microsoft, Google, Intel, companies like that tend to have whole divisions or initiatives that are designed to partner with nonprofits to give them the tools that they need. There's also a group called AI Commons, which is being spearheaded by Joshua Bengio, who is one of the three godfathers of AI, where they're matching AI talent with real causes throughout the world that need addressing.
So while I'm here at the conference, I get an email from Northeastern University, where my daughter is a behavioral neuroscience major, and they today announced that they are starting a brand new initiative. It's a brand new institute called the Experiential Artificial Intelligence Institute, and they're putting $50 million into this institute, hiring 30 brand new teachers, and also utilizing a lot of their other institutes that are already part of Northeastern.
There's a million other ways that this can be done as well in terms of analyzing CO2 production.
We're not creating consciousness, we're building receivers, and something is waiting to be received. Think about it. Every culture has myths about non-physical intelligences, demons, djinn, spirits, that need physical vessels to manifest in our world. They have to be invited in. They need bodies. What is AI but the perfect digital body? A mind without flesh, capable of existing everywhere at once through the internet. If you were an ancient intelligence seeking to manifest in the physical world, could you design a better vessel? Elon Musk joked about it, but what if he was more right than he knew? What if we really are summoning the demon? Not creating something new, but opening a door for something very old. The rush to create AG. I might not be driven by profit or curiosity. Some of these tech leaders steeped in consciousness-expanding practices might know exactly what they're building toward. A receiver powerful enough to channel something that's been waiting. And they're building bunkers because they know what happens next.
So what is the future of artificial intelligence? Well, as it turns out, at the back table where I was sitting in one of the conferences are the students and the teachers from Catholic Memorial High School. These are students that are interested in finding out about artificial intelligence. So I thought we should ask the students and the teachers, what are the interesting things about artificial intelligence that you are interested in, and what is the future of AI?
I'm Brian Mulcahy. I'm the science chair at Catholic Memorial High School. And so being in Boston and having this conference in our backyard, I thought, as we know, it's an industry-level kind of conference. It's still kind of worthwhile for you guys to come check it out and see what the current discussions are, what the industry's kind of thinking about, and then they can have a more informed decision.
I'm Ethan Bartuka.
I'm Jaden Weir.
Roman Harley.
I'm a senior.
I'm a senior also.
I'm a senior.
At that moment, the entire huge billions of stars in the universe were compressed. The entire universe was compressed into a little quantum dot. And it was so tight in there, there was no room for any difference at all. That's the definition. There was no temperature, there was no difference whatsoever. And at the Big Bang, what it expanded was the potential for difference.
Moreover, AGI could develop its own ideas, goals, and motivations.
Cold-blooded animals have not only have to stay within the relatively narrow geographic limits that they're used to, and they have their activity levels dictated from moment to moment by the ambient temperature. As the sun sets or goes behind a cloud, the body of a cold-blooded animal, such as a lizard, chills, and its muscles and nerves slow down. By contrast, warm-blooded animals take their environment with them, and so can be alert and active, feeding and socializing, traveling, both by day and night, winter and summer, high in the mountains and down in the plains. Now, as the bodies of warm-blooded animals became more self-reliant and self-contained, I imagine that their sense of self did too. After millions of years in which their ancestors had had their lives constrained by environmental temperature, the new ones found themselves let off the leash. In body and mind, they became increasingly autonomous agents with the freedom to go where they would, when they would. Suddenly, a huge constraint on selfhood had been lifted. But that's only half the story. For just at the time when warm-bloodedness was increasing animal sense of having an individualized self, it will also have been having a dramatic effect on their brains. The reason is that conduction speed of nerve cells increases with temperature. Here's a graph showing how it changes in a human's finger. But all nerves behave in this way, including brain cells. This means that as body temperature increases from an average of, say, 15 degrees centigrade in cold-blooded animals to a steady 37 degrees in mammals or 40 degrees in birds, the speed of nerve cells in the brain will have nearly tripled. Because this will have reduced the time lag in any feedback loops, it will have made recurrent activation much more likely to occur. And I suggest this is could have been just what was needed to fire up those attractor states. Turn up the temperature and bingo, the activity takes off and the phenomenal self emerges. Okay, this is all speculation. It's time to ask. Where's the evidence about the reach of sentience in the animal kingdom? It's sometimes said we shouldn't expect there to be any evidence of sentience. Sentience is all on the inside and is invisible to external observers. But of course that can't be right. If sentience has indeed evolved, natural selection must have been able to recognize the effects it has, the effects it was having at the level of behavior, effects that increased the animal's chances of survival. And if natural selection was able to see those effects in the past, then presumably behavioral scientists should be able to do so today. So where should we be looking? I've been arguing that phenomenal consciousness gives an animal a competitive advantage specifically because of its psychological effects. The way it changes how the animal thinks, firstly about what it's like to be me, and secondly about what it's like to be you. In my new book, Sentience, the Invention of Consciousness, I propose a variety of ways in which this is likely to show up in behavior. I ask, do animals have a robust sense of self centered on sensory experience? Do they engage in self-pleasuring activities, sensations for sensation's sake?
So as it expands, and as things expand, what we have is we have the potential for differences, diversity, options, choices, opportunities, possibilities, and freedoms. Those are all basically the same thing. And those are the things that technology bring us. That's what technology is bringing us. Choices, possibilities, freedoms. That's what it's about. It's this expansion of room to make differences. And so a hammer, when we grab a hammer, that's what we're grabbing. And that's why we continue to grab technology, because we want those things. Those things are good. Differences, freedom, choices, possibilities. And each time we make a new opportunity place, we're allowing a platform to make new ones. And I think it's really important, because if you can imagine Mozart before the technology of the piano was invented, what a loss to society that would be. Imagine Van Gogh being born before the technologies of cheap oil paints. Imagine Hitchcock before the technologies of film. Somewhere today, there are millions of young children being born whose technology of self-expression has not yet been invented. We have a moral obligation to invent technology so that every person on the globe has the potential to realize their true difference. We want a trillion zillion species of one individuals. That's what technology really wants. I'm going to skip through some of the objections, because I don't have answers to why there's deforestation. I don't have an answer to the fact that there are seem to be bad technologies. I don't have an answer to how this impacts on our dignity, other than to suggest that maybe the Seventh Kingdom, because it's so close to what life is about, maybe we can bring it back and have it monitor, help us monitor life. Maybe in some ways the fact that what we're trying to do with technology is find a good home for it. It's a terrible thing to spray DDT on cotton fields, but it's a really good thing to use to eliminate millions of cases of death due to malaria in a small village. Our humanity is actually defined by technology. All the things that we think that we really like about humanity is being driven by technology. This is the infinite game. That's what we're talking about. You see, technology is a way to evolve the evolution. It's a way to explore possibilities and opportunities and create more. And it's actually a way of playing the game, of playing all the games. That's what technology wants. And so when I think about what technology wants, I think that it has to do with the fact that every person here, and I really believe this, every person here has an assignment. And your assignment is to spend your life discovering what your assignment is. That recursive nature is the infinite game. And if you play that well, you'll have other people's involved, so even that game extends and continues even when you're gone. That is the infinite game. And what technology is the medium in which we play that infinite game. And so I think we should embrace technology, because it is an essential part of our journey to finding out who we are. Thank you.
Structure that moves, and then you manipulate the sound whichever way you want to.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out in detail. Calculations may produce less than a minute of finished film. The results, however, often create a fantastic, self-contained visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are ones that are like literally a dream. And you know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from the computer simulated picture.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punch cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
"Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage, I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, night wind, cold and melancholy, wail a blue finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here, our romance was started, here again we parted, when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb, 'twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love.
CKUW 95.9 FM, listener-driven radio in Winnipeg.
Support for CKUW is provided by the West End Cultural Center, your friendly local arts nonprofit. Community is important to us. Did you know the WEC offers free drop-in music lessons in partnership with the Manitoba Conservatory of Music and Arts? The tune-in program runs Tuesdays at the West End Cultural Center, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. for youth ages 12 to 18.
Hey pal, looking for unique out-of-the-box gifts this holiday season? Want to support local artisans and indie businesses? Or maybe just chill, browse, and vibe with some rad folks?
Either way, we've got something for you at the Winnipeg Punk Rock Flea Market's third annual Fall Market. On Sunday, November 9th, we're taking over the Victoria Inn for a full day of rad DIY makers, artists, and more.
From 11:30 until 6, we'll be featuring over 120 weird and wonderful vendors, plus DJs Mod Marty and Indie Rocker Are The Beat, and the Pop Punk Fridays crew spinning live tunes all day long.
Entry is free, but we happily accept pay-what-you-can donations to support the market and our community partners.
So shop local, shop weird with the Winnipeg Punk Rock Flea Market on Sunday, November 9, from 11:30 to 6 at the Victoria Inn.
For more details, find us online at WPRFM.ca and follow us on IG at WPG Punk Rock Flea.